Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Gelina. I am here this afternoon with Sarah Morgan, Director of IT PMO Infrastructure at Fresenius Medical Care North America. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, question that I often ask folks right out of the gate is, what got you excited about technology, or what keeps you excited about it?
Well, it's kind of funny because in high school, there was a single programming class. I don't want to date myself, but it was a long time ago. And
Pascal or Basic?
I don't even remember. It was something very fundamental. And I had homework in my computer programming class. And it wasn't that I was actually interacting with a terminal or anything. It was a logic assignment. And I got sick and I had a sick day and I had a fever and I'm in bed really sick. And I couldn't stop working on the computer logic problem. And I had the pad and the pencil and I'm trying to figure this thing out. And I'm realizing I'm sick as a dog and I'm still trying to figure this thing out. So that was clue number one. And then clue number two, we had a really good guidance counselor office in the high school, and they administered tests like the Cooter Occupational Interest Survey that is still available. You'd think I'd get my kids to do it, but no. Maybe somebody else's kids will hear this and actually take these. It's a 100-question test with three answers, and you choose the answer that fits your personality and what you like to do the most. And then it compares your answers to people who are happy in their field. And then they do this correlation thing and they come back with a list of the occupations that you might be most suited to. And the top two for me were computer programming and nursing. And I saw nursing and I thought, well, I'm not going to all those years of medical school. Not interested in all of that. But computer programming, well, okay, I believe that. And then when I went to college, having learned that much about myself in high school, I thought, well, yeah, I'm going to take some computer programming classes and see how it goes. And they ended up forming a major just in time for me to graduate as the first computer science major, one of six, two women, four men, if I recall correctly. I remember being very jealous of the guy that got a job at Apple right out of college, but I did get a job in a software company right out of college and been a long road since then.
I took some comp sci courses in college, but I was always a little intimidated at first of some of the more advanced comp sci. But then as I took them and got more into it and then got into some of the graduate level courses and actually ended up TAing one of those by the time I was graduating, you kind of build on it and you get there eventually and feel like I'm not an imposter. I do belong here.
Yeah, I was at one of the college reunions and a woman who I greatly respected came up to me and said, "You were my teaching assistant for computer science. It was the only class I had so much trouble with, and you were so nice to me." And I'm like, I don't even remember you coming in, but I got paid for whatever it was I helped you with.
Well, you helped make someone's life a little bit easier and maybe spark their interest in comp sci. After college, then you mentioned you got into the industry. As a woman in the software industry, I have three daughters. They're 15, 13, and 11. What do you think you'd kind of whisper in their ear if you could tell them something about the industry?
I think things have evolved a lot, and I didn't perceive a significant gender problem when I entered the industry. There were kind of an equal number of women and men when I got my first job, so I didn't see anything initially. Eventually, I started to notice perhaps that women were often relegated to roles of taking notes, being the ones in charge of ordering food, doing a bunch of the administrative stuff. I'd watch out for that trend, ensure that you're doing the same amount as anybody else is doing and not becoming the de facto administrative assistant.
All right. So don't be afraid to assert yourself and show what you can contribute and not kind of fall into that role.
Yeah. Not my turn. Somebody else's turn.
Fair enough. I think that's good advice for anyone getting into comp sci. So, Sarah, over the course of your career, there's definitely been several different roles. You've been an individual contributor, manager, manager of managers. What was the trajectory and what did you learn each step along the way?
You know, I came out with a computer science degree and I thought, well, that means I have to be a programmer. And you know, that's not what I am right now. So sometimes the path isn't straight, but certain skills will evolve and they will be transportable across roles, transportable across industries. trust that you're developing the right things. For me, being a developer allowed me to understand business requirements, understand how to translate them into code, understand that testing was critical, and having a launch plan and a rollback plan were critical. And those skills then got me promoted to managing programmers and then managing managers of programmers. And those skills had to evolve, and they did. And then there was sort of a lateral move into project management, all the same skills, different title. The only difference was that I wasn't responsible for people's reviews, although the hiring managers asked for my feedback, so I was indirectly responsible for their reviews. But all those skills were still necessary in IT project manager role. You still had to understand the business requirements. You had to understand how to translate that into the technical requirements. You had to understand how to test it, how to deploy it, and how to follow up on the issues. And the other set of skills there wasn't just the comprehension, but the follow-up. And following up in a way that isn't nagging, that builds relationships, doesn't tear them down. Those are skills that, again, translate across IT, business, different verticals. I was in software development. I was in retail, education technology. And now I'm in medical care, completely new industry to me, learning all about kidney care. But all the same skills are still the skills that are needed to execute according to the business plan. Still have to understand what the problem is, what the business is trying to do, how to translate it into what needs to be done technically, how to execute that, test it, deploy it. It's all the same skills.
Now, how were you able to move across verticals? Because I know, especially on the East Coast, everyone's attitude is, I want someone that's done this before.
Yeah.
I want someone with X years of experience in Y industry.
Yeah.
How are you able to make that leap?
It's not what you know, it's who you know. I followed people that I'd worked with at the prior company who already knew what my transferable skills were and knew that I would learn the new thing really fast. And it was a great experience. I loved learning the new thing. I loved proving that my skills were fully transportable and I could still add value someplace where I didn't necessarily know the industry initially, but I learned it fast. And now I'm doing it all over again, switching from education technology to medical care. I followed people I knew again, and they take the leap of faith knowing that I'm a fast learner and that I am going to add the same value I added at the prior company they worked with me. So I can't say that it was that my resume got me in the door. It was who I knew.
Well, we've actually had to do the same thing as a company. A lot of us came from Monster.com and had worked in internet type companies, and then financial services got pulled in because of someone we knew. Mm-hmm. To start solving problems in FinServe and then insurance and then EdTech eventually, because we knew someone that was at X company. They trusted us to get the job done there. They moved to a different vertical or a different company and pulled us in. So I think the same thing ends up applying across the board.
Yeah.
And again, the importance of building that network and building it when you don't need it and then having it come in handy when you do.
You know, I mentioned the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which is Stephen Covey. And his son wrote another book that was just as good called The Speed of Trust. And that trust word has come up a number of times when we were talking about networking, when we were talking about following people or getting into new industries. Earning people's trust is probably one of the most important things you can do for your career. And it's non-trivial. And it's a force multiplier. Teams that trust each other get more done than they would otherwise, and teams that don't trust each other get less done than they would have otherwise. That's the gist of speed of trust, is that you go faster if people trust each other.
Huh. I hadn't thought of that one, but it definitely applies. I'll have to read that book as well.
Lack of trust is a tax, and speed of trust and the abundance of trust is an interest, if you're thinking about it in terms of finances.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's cool. You mentioned being able to follow up people and without nagging, but persistently pushing the right amount in order to create a sense of urgency, mm-hmm. get stuff done, iron out dependencies. I think that's the art part of project management.
Yeah, I try to remember all the time that we're on the same side of the table as a team, looking at the problem on the other side of the table. So if I'm following up on something, I'm not nagging them. I'm reminding them of our shared objective to solve that problem on the other side of the table. And it feels different to the receiver when it's more like somebody as a coach who's orchestrating people on all one side, instead of us versus them or a confrontational kind of thing where you're saying, you haven't done it yet. Why haven't you done it?
Mm.
It's, wow, we really need that. What do you need to get that done? Can I help in some way? It's a very different conversation.
Is there anything I can do to unblock you or get you more time?
Exactly.
Take something off your plate.
Yeah, then you start getting into that whole scrum master, servant leadership kind of thought process, which is the right way to approach things as a team.
So actually, even though I had Lynn Morgan on one of our episodes and we talked a lot about Agile and Scrum, I don't think we talked about servant leadership. What's your kind of take on that? Well, I guess define it first for those who don't know.
Okay, so servant leadership, I can't quite look it up right now. I would Google it if I had time, but instead of command and control, you are actively listening to what the people doing the work need and then unblocking them. And you're serving them by listening and removing obstacles and letting them forge ahead. So it is a lead from behind as opposed to a drag from in front.
Okay. It reminds me a lot of like when I was a developer and would have to get folks in other groups to cooperate. Maybe there wasn't a PM for this particular project and I've kind of became the de facto one. I had no authority or power to say, hey, I need you to do this. In fact, I was often asking them to do something that was not in their job description or an add-on to get my project done and trying to influence someone and get them to get on board with your thing. I think that's a skill that a lot of folks find themselves having to cultivate and learn.
You have to pay it forward sometimes. You have to do favors for other people so that when you actually need something in return, they want to help you. You're not calling in a favor at that point. They want to help you because you've helped them. And that gets into earning trust as well. If you've already helped them out, they now trust you to help them out again, and they want to earn your trust in return.
So throughout your career, you've networked with folks and joined some networking groups, one that we have in common, Sim Boston. Can you tell us a bit about what your experience was like there and what the group's about?
It's amazing how many years I went with zero networking other than the people within the large company I worked for. And I used to think that networking was a very self-serving, self-absorbed, self-aggrandizing activity that was the kind of people that did that were not the kind of people I wanted to hang out with. The Society of Information Management, SIM, in Boston, I got involved in them initially for their regional leadership forum, which was a very intense forum where people had to be very authentic and genuine and open and honest about who they were and what they were working on as leaders. And that introduction to the people that chose to be in that was amazing. And then I got introduced to people in the organization beyond the training and realized that it pervaded the entire organization. And it wasn't self-serving, self-aggrandizing, self-absorbed. It was people who were genuine and people I really liked and people who helped each other out. And so I tell stories about how I used to think it was a bad thing, and Sim Boston changed my opinion of what it really means. And now I encourage it.
Yeah, I've been part of and seen a bunch of networking groups, and they do run the gamut. There are definitely plenty that are, you know, your local real estate agent, a banker, a car salesman, and someone else that, you know, maybe for a transaction, it makes sense to know those folks, but they're not really involved in the technology industry. They're not really facing the same challenges and issues that you are every day and every week. And I think it is refreshing, especially in the networking groups that I've seen, Mass TLC, the Technology Leadership Council there, and Sim Boston, to really be involved with folks that are in leadership in technology, are excited about the industry, are excited about what they can bring to the table and sharing with one another. And there's definitely a lot to be learned there. So I've appreciated those.
It's the depth of relationships that I find the surprise. They're real, genuine, trusting friendships. It's not some shallow, I'll see you when I see you kind of relationship that gets developed there. So I really appreciate it.
Woohoo! This is my 25th recruiter call for the same job today. New high score! The 3-week wait between my first interview and my second interview is my favorite time of year.
My recruiter says he is my best friend, but I haven't heard from him since I started the job 2 years ago.
Your background in real estate and multi-level marketing makes you the perfect person to advise me on tech careers.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserve, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry.
So you were also an officer in Sim Boston, correct?
Yeah, I did get tapped to help run first a logical extension of the Regional Leadership Forum program that I was a participant in. We chose to call it a continuation of it. It had a couple of different names, but I did facilitate that program first, and then that had me on the board, and I was observing the board and participating in board meetings. And then eventually I was nominated for the secretary position, which I did for a year, and then I was nominated for the treasurer position, which I did for 2 years, which was a lot of work. And then I was nominated for the vice president, which is the president-elect. And then president, and then past president. So it was probably 7 years on the board. And I have to say, I did need a break. But I've come back because I missed it. And now I'm on the board again for Sim Women.
And what do you enjoy about being on the board?
There was a moment at an event where everybody was gathering to be a group photo of all the board members. And I realized, well, I'm not technically a board member. And they were dragging me along. I'm going, well, I'm really not a board member. It's not right for me to step into that position. And I realized, but I want to be in that picture. So after that, I said, you know, I'm ready to come back.
Very cool. So what about networking groups like Sim as far as job seeking? Like, do folks end up going there kind of looking to make connections for the next step in their career? Is it useful for that? Is it not really for that? What do you think?
There is definitely a vibrant community of members in transition. That used to be the name of it. Member career development, I think, is what we call it now. Before some events, there is a session specifically tailored for people who are looking for their next career. And it has been really interesting. I was recently in transition myself. I went to at least one event that was really well done. I learned a lot from it. I was then connected with somebody who was actively keeping an ear open for me for the kind of role I was looking for. And he did hear about one, and he got me connected to the hiring manager the same day. And I did talk through that position before it was even posted publicly with the hiring VP. For a position that might have been the right one. In the end, it didn't turn out to be the right one, but the connection was amazing and the speed in which it happened.
Yeah, being able to fast track something and knowing someone on the inside of a company definitely changes the whole experience. I mean, everyone I talk to laments having to lob their resume into a black hole and hope they hear back and not getting feedback after phone screens and so forth. So yeah, it's such a huge help to have a network, either through like a membership like a Sim Boston or even just on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of folks that might leave a job or get laid off and they're trying to figure out what to do next. And they'll ask me like, hey, do you know someone at this company? I'm saying, hey, look on LinkedIn. If you see me as a connection, I am happy to introduce you to folks and try to get you to that fast track in order to move things along.
I have absolutely leveraged the LinkedIn connections heavily. Even when I was a hiring manager, I would always look at everybody whose resume made it to me. I would look and see, do I know anybody that knows this person already? After I've looked at their resume, if I'm interested, then I follow up with the shared connection and say, would you recommend this person before I even decide whether to bring them in? And then on the reverse, I check out whether the company's worth working for. How are you feeling about working there? Do you know the hiring manager? Do you think it would be a good fit for me? You know, it was really powerful network.
Do you ever use Glassdoor or anything like that?
I used Glassdoor to see what they were publicly posting to. But I relied more on the interpersonal connections of my LinkedIn connections than I did on Glassdoor.
Yeah, Glassdoor's been a mixed bag. Sometimes you find that little gem or nugget that's anonymously posted that you might not find out otherwise. sometimes it's just someone who's sour grapes just
lighting
a former company on fire.
And sometimes, you know, companies ask people to put good things out there too. So you get false positives and you get overreaction, false negatives. So it's a harder one to digest, but talking to mutual connections is easier and safer.
Yep. So tell me a bit about perspective. Like, why do you think attitude is so important in this industry?
Yeah, it's funny. I wanted to talk about this and I went to Google and I Googled attitude is everything. And there were 330 quotes on wisdom quotes. And I thought, wow. And I started skimming through them and I found some of my favorites. And one of them was Maya Angelou's, "If you don't like something, change it. If you can't change it, change your attitude." And there's been a lot of cases where there's no value in looking in the past and seeing nothing but negative feelings. If you shift your perspective, you can often make the past look like it was exactly what it was supposed to be. That it had to happen that way for you to be who you are now. It had to happen that way for you to land where you landed. I got fired from the first job out of college, but it landed me at Staples before they went public, and I stayed there 27 years. It was perfect that I got fired from that job because I was the right fit for Staples at that time, and I was the wrong fit for a software development company where software was their product. I wasn't a perfect programmer. So I can look back at that and say that was exactly the right thing that happened to me at the right time.
But at the time, it doesn't always feel that way.
No, it didn't feel good at all. And you got to own what you did wrong, too. I mean, I'm not saying ignore your own flaws. I'm saying move beyond them and choose your perspective on it.
Yep. I think there's something to be said there when just working with other people, too. My dad always used to try to instill in me, you cannot change other people. No matter how hard you try, usually they're not going to change. They're going to act the way they're going to act. The only thing you can control is how you react.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be something as little as someone cutting you off on the highway to, you know, something big at work or an interaction with a family member where they're just trying to get under your skin or digging at you. And you got to sometimes take a deep breath and say, you know what? I'm not going to feed into this. I'm not going to
go after it. There was a parsing of the word responsibility in the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People where it parsed it into responsibility. We have the ability to control our response to a situation. And that gave a whole different perspective on responsibility and what that actually means.
One of my other favorite habits from that book was begin with the end in mind. Mm-hmm. Think about where you want to be and then start working backwards into smaller, more manageable steps as to how you're going to get there. There's oftentimes I'll want to be somewhere or do something or achieve something, whether it's at the company here or, you know, with my family or whatever, and it seems insurmountable or just so big. But if you start thinking about where you want to be and then start working backwards, well, what's the step before that? What's the step before that?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon you arrive at, well, there's a step I can take right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like to use that thought process too with conflict and trying to figure out if the end that you want is a win-win situation. How do you get to that instead of it being a win-lose? So I like to think about the end you want when you're dealing with conflict as well. But yeah, the number of quotes on perspective was incredible. Another one that I've used with my own kids, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results. And my daughter at one point just didn't write down her homework or whatever. And it would be the same problem over and over again. And I finally said that to her and it clicked. I said, so what are you going to do differently so this doesn't keep happening to you? And she changed. And I keep that quote around because I catch myself doing the same thing and expecting different results. So that's another one that I'm quite fond of.
I'm still trying to get through to my daughter with the alarm clock and that same lesson, but mixed results.
Yeah, my daughter has gotten good with the alarm clock. And I do think that she had to ask herself, if it keeps failing, how do I fix it? The other thing that I think a lot about when I'm thinking about maintaining the right perspective as opposed to just a perspective, the right perspective, is there's a quote by Mahatma Gandhi that I don't know the exact wording of, but it's along the lines of watch your thoughts for they become words, watch your words for they become actions, watch your actions for they become habits, watch your habits, they become character, And character is everything, and it determines your destiny. So I don't have the exact words, but every once in a while I catch myself thinking something really negative, and I say, stop thinking that, or it's going to come out of my mouth.
Yeah, it does tend to manifest itself, either in how you act towards other people, or how you tackle a task, mm-hmm. or how you don't tackle a task.
And you're a role model to your kids, and you got to catch yourself, or you're going to demonstrate the wrong thing. So, parenthood, not for the feeble.
Yeah, or the faint of heart.
Exactly.
So, we both have kids that participate in sports. Can you tell me a bit about what your kids are up to and maybe how they leverage technology in their sports?
Yep, both my kids. I have a junior and a senior in high school. My son has two sports, though one of them's a little atypical. His primary sport is lacrosse, and he'll be playing that in college. But his true passion is fishing, and he's a bass fisherman. We fish in Maine. He's also an ice fisherman. And the technology that he uses to get better and better at what he does is YouTube and a device called Avexilar, which he probably wouldn't have known about except for YouTube. And Avexilar is a fish-finding sonar that sends sound waves from a transducer, and it tells you where your hook is, where the fish are, when the fish are approaching your hook, and eliminates all of the doubt.
And guesswork.
And if there's no fish where you drill the hole, you just move the hole and drill another one until you find the fish, and then you put the hook in the right place. It almost takes all the magic out of it, but he's good with it. So now there's two Vexilars between him and his friends, and because they were fighting over the one that was available. And then YouTube is just literally a game changer, because no matter what sport you're in, and it's not limited to sports, but we're talking about sports at the moment, no matter what sport you're in, you can go research the best players, and they probably have clips out there that will teach you something that your coach didn't know. Dylan knows more about fishing gear and fishing signs and how to determine based on the barometric pressure rising or falling what kind of gear to use. And he learned all this on YouTube. So that's amazing. And then I remember watching one of the best lacrosse players on YouTube as well. And some of the tricks that were involved in the mechanics of what he did were also explained. So between the Vexilar and YouTube, fishing was covered. And then for lacrosse, the software that I remember dealing with the most often was a tourney machine. It has live scores if you want to do it. They're not the official score, but some parent on the sideline can actually live score it, and then the official score will override it. But you can get the blow-by-blow if somebody wants to post it. And then registration and waivers and the actual tournament placement team by team is all available on a mobile app on your phone. We got pretty used to having that. Didn't used to be the case.
Yeah, my kids have been a part of soccer teams mostly for a long time, and the old reply all emails and where's the game and God forbid, what's the score and what's going on during it. Yeah, email's not built for that.
No.
So you liked Tourney Machine?
Tourney Machine. Yeah, that was the one that I liked the best, but there were other ones as well, I remember. Well, there's the MIAA website that gives you information, but it isn't interactive like this. It's just a repository of facts.
Yeah, we've been using one called Team Snap with club soccer that the girls are in. And it's nice because it does the basics, you know, who's going to be here for what practice, what game, will you be available for an away game, what's the roster, communicating with everyone without having to know everyone's email and phone number and such. But it also gives you calendar feeds that you can then pull into Outlook and overlay. So I have three daughters with three different schedules. One year, I actually paid for the youngest daughter's team to get Team Snap because they didn't have it. It was like $65 for the year for everyone. I was like, sure, I'll happily pay it just to have that third calendar feed that
right.
I could overlay and figure out how to get everyone everywhere.
Right.
But back to the ice fishing thing, that is an absolute game changer. When I was growing up, I used to go ice fishing with my Uncle John. He used to drive us out to this place called Thousand Acre Swamp. I think it's in like Northwest Connecticut. I lived in Western Mass. And we'd drive the cars out onto the ice and he'd drill all the holes randomly, put the tip ups in there. And then we'd all sit somewhere and
watch for the orange flag.
Yeah. And then everyone would have the crampons on their feet and fight to get to that flag. It almost sounds like shooting fish in a barrel. I like the sound of that. If you can make it warm too, then maybe I might go ice fishing again.
Yeah, right.
When I first saw YouTube, I don't know what, 06 or whenever it came out, you know, everyone's uploading cat videos and stuff. I'm like, this is absolutely useless. And then, you know, a few years ago, my daughters were like, oh yeah, this person is a YouTuber and they're a YouTuber as opposed to like a television star or a radio person or a movie star. And I'm like, you can actually make a living from that. It's just mind blowing. But then as I got more into podcasting and now doing videos for the podcast, I am absolutely voraciously inhaling YouTube videos. And there's these people out there that put out these instructional videos for free that you're like, I cannot believe they take the time to do this.
They're really high quality, some of them. I mean, they really, really crafted a solution for you, and it's just sitting there waiting for you to find it for free.
Yeah. There's a guy called Luke Searveld. He's out in San Francisco. He's a gaffer, which is like a professional that does the lighting for commercials, movies, TV shows, whatever. And so I wanted to learn how to light video here so we can make our stuff look decent. He has 180 videos out there. Now, a lot of it's like gear that I'm never going to afford, like a $43,000 light that they use for certain applications. But the basic concepts and stuff, you can soak it up all there for free. Have you done any YouTube trolling in order to learn anything lately?
I think I have used it for recipes, like how to cook certain things that I wasn't confident in. But other than that, not a lot. I haven't had a lot of time to troll it.
Yeah, we've used it actually at our house too for recipes, especially if there's some sort of non-standard chopping or technique to it that you're not quite sure about. The video recipe is a little bit better than the written one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sarah, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll talk to everyone again soon on the next episode of Underserved.